Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us, along with critics Manuel Betancourt. He's contributing editor at Film Quarterly, and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com, and the co-host of the Breakfast All Day YouTube and podcast series. We begin with Dune Part 2, which is opening with sneak previews this coming Sunday evening at IMAX venues all over Southern California. Denis Villeneuve back as the director, of course. Part 1 was such a huge smash. Christy, share with us what you thought of Part 2.
Oh, it's incredible. And to see it in IMAX would just be an incredible treat. So if you can get tickets, jump on that. The second you get done listening to Film Week, go jump on tickets because it's going to get pretty sold out. It's just as much as the first, if not more so, an incredible visual spectacle. The score, the cinematography, the costume design. But now Paul Atreides is, you know, stepping into his role as the Messiah, if that is indeed what he is. It's got greater emotional depth than the first. It is every bit as awesome visually as the first, but all that world building is done and they just jump right in. The new character additions to this one, including Austin Butler, who is terrifying as Fade Rotha. Florence Pugh is very good in it, Christopher Walken, but it's just thrilling and harrowing. It's longer than the first, but it moves beautifully. Go get you some Dune 2.
2 hours, 46 minutes, by the way, the running time on Dune Part 2, and much of the cast from the first one. Was there a pause, do you know, between the two parts, or did they try and film these consecutively?
So I believe that they were filmed at the same time, and it very much picks up exactly where the first Dune ends, and there's no previously on Dune, so you really need to have seen the first Dune okay. Kind of recently to know, because they throw you right in there in the desert with Paul and Shawnee. So Timothée Chalamet becomes a man before your very eyes in Dune Part 2.
And next week on Film Week, we'll also be hearing from our critics. As the movie goes into wide release, we'll hear some more details about Dune Part 2. Drive Away Dolls is in wide release. Ethan Coen, half of the Coen brothers, of course, is the director and co-screenwriter with Trisha Cook. Margaret Qualley stars along with Geraldine Viswanathan and Beanie Feldstein. Christy, what do you think of the action comedy thriller Drive Away Dolls?
Oh, this is a mixed bag. And it's a mixed bag of some very familiar stuff that we have seen. If you are a fan of the Coen brothers, as I very much am, they're my favorite filmmakers probably. This is Ethan Coen on his own, directing and co-writing with his wife, Trisha Cook, and is about these two lesbians who go on a road trip to Florida. They go down to Tallahassee, but there's a whole mix-up because they take the car that's actually meant for some other bumbling criminals, and there's stuff in the car that they don't know about. It's got a lot of the bumbling, inept criminal stuff of Burn After Reading, for example. There's a pair of people after our main characters who are very much out of Fargo in that, like, they're bickering and they hate each other. There are these psychedelic mind trips of The Big Lebowski. And then there's all of that, like, you know, rhythmic, repetitious Coen brothers writing. The thing that can be so thrilling about how certain phrases come back over and over again and have different meaning in different situations. But we've seen so much of this done better before that it just feels like a sort of a watered down greatest hits collection. Margaret Qualley is kind of doing Austin Butler as Elvis here, right? Speaking of Austin Butler, there's like a big muscular kind of swaggering showiness to the role. And Beanie Feldstein does not get to do very much at all. And then you have like Colman Domingo underused, Pedro Pascal underused, Matt Damon underused, like tantalizing stuff with a great supporting cast, but never really comes together.
And Drive Away Dolls, Manuel.
Yeah, this is truly bonkers because I think when you describe it as sort of this like road trip, lesbian comedy romp from one of the Coen brothers, you're like, yes, I'm all in. I want Margaret Qualley playing a butch lesbian who's like has this sort of southern drawl. I was like, yes, I'm totally. Benny Feldstein, like as the aggrieved ex-lover, there's like so many parts of it that I really wanted to love and I really gravitated to. But I think the difference, and I'm glad you brought up like Fargo and Born After Reading, because there's a discipline to that comedy. And I think that's what was missing to me. This feels so unwieldy, almost intentionally. And it is very baggy and it's very messy. And there's these interstitials that are like kind of 60s-esque. And I just couldn't tell, like it's set in the contemporary times, but it has this sort of like weird psychedelic interstitials. And I didn't understand what a lot of it was happening. I will say they all seem to be having a great time. But yeah, to me, I just wanted more discipline so that the comedy would land better rather than we found this joke and we're going to use it and then we're going to go somewhere else and we're going to meet another bumbling idiot and they were all bumbling idiots. And so, but if raunchy lesbian road trip comedy from one of the Coen brothers speaks to you, I think you're going to find a lot of things to love.
It does sound promising on paper, at least, even if it didn't show it on the screen. Drive Away Dolls in wide release is rated R. Ordinary Angels has a liver transplant at the center of the plot. Hilary Swank and Alan Ritchson star John Gunn is the director. Manuel.
I wrote on my notes, no thank you. And that probably sounds very, very harsh, but I did not buy this sort of kind of faith-based drama where we're following this alcoholic woman, Hilary Swank, who one day decides that she's not going to be an alcoholic and that she's going to do instead is raise money for this liver transplant for this young girl that she has never met. It's based on a true story, and I gather what I felt was that because it was based on a true story, the script didn't feel the need to explain why any of these character motivations made any sense. So it's like, well, the real woman did this, so Hilary Swank is going to do that. But it never sort of fleshes out why she would be driven to this, why this of all places, why this, this young girl, why this family would actually drive her to change her entire personality. It's very much like a spirit of the will and everyone, you know, it's a little bit maudlin. It's a little bit sentimental. Hilary Swank is doing all of the things. I think she can be very captivating on screen and she's doing the best that she can, but this script truly is not doing her any favors.
We're talking about Ordinary Angels. Christy.
This is Hilary Swank's Erin Brockovich role, isn't it?
She even looks like her, yes.
Right? Like the same kind of hair and like mini skirts that are too short and too tight for her age and just like a little too flashy, a little too tacky, a little too brash, but well-meaning, right? Awesome. And like a bulldozer of a personality. I kind of bought that she would take the alcoholic instincts and put them someplace else, right? That happens a lot with people who are in recovery. Like, you got to take that addictive instinct and like apply it to something else. So like maybe you're into running now, or maybe you go to church all the time now, or whatever it is. So for her, she's never really dealing with the stuff that makes her who she is. She's just putting it elsewhere, putting the energy elsewhere and putting it someplace else for good. I mean, the family is understandably a little bit like, huh? Like, why are you showing up in my life? And a lot of this does seem kind of implausible and, as you say, maudlin, but it did really happen. There's a whole like climactic thing involving a helicopter, and this is like before cell phones, right? So like people are calling into a TV station to arrange a helicopter to get the transplant, and I was actually surprised at how little faith-based stuff there is here, because in the very first scene they do mention like prayer and God. This was written by Kelly Fremon Craig, who wrote and directed Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which is excellent, which is one of the best films of last year. So I feel like she maybe brings a recognizable humanity here and there to this that might not exist in other people's hands. But this is ultimately very like faith affirming. So if you want that and maybe a better made version of a faith based film, this could service that.
We're talking about Ordinary Angels, starring Hilary Swank and Alan Ritchson. Joe Gunn directed, Kelly Freeman Craig wrote the screenplay. It's rated PG in wide release. The documentary The Ark of Oblivion is directed by Ian Chaney, who also narrates the film. Christy?
I love this movie, and Manuel, I have to thank you for putting it at the top of your list, because I then made sure that I watched it.
Yes.
And I'm so glad I did, because I love it so much, and it works so beautifully on so many different levels. It's about this guy who is the filmmaker, Ian Chaney, and he is building a literal ark in his family's field in Maine, like an actual ark to put all of his stuff in. Because he realizes, like, I've got too much stuff. It's all building up. I got to put it somewhere. So in the very, like, intimate, literal sense, it's about storage. But he takes that as a launching pad for this, like, existential exploration of why we as humans feel the need to leave traces of ourselves behind, whether it is through, you know, passing on photos or filmmaking, literally filmmaking. Like, why must we record and keep things? Why do people collect weird things? He goes into, like, tree rings and stalagmites and, like, an ecotoxicologist who trolls the Arctic waters for, like, remnants of pharmaceuticals that are left behind. It is fascinating. If you've ever wanted to hear Werner Herzog recite Ozymandias, now is your chance. It's brilliant. And it's really playful, given how, like, this is substantial stuff he's talking about. The form of it is really playful. There's a lot of stop motion animation. There's a lot of cool stuff he does with vintage television sets. I really liked it a lot.
Ian Chaney is the director and at the center of The Ark of Oblivion. Manuel, I'm not familiar with him. Has he done other documentaries?
Yeah, and I'm so happy, Chris, that you enjoyed it, because yes. As soon as I watched it, I fell in love with this movie. I love especially documentaries that are driven by curiosity. And so at the heart of this is this question, are we insane to believe that anything can last? Like, if we know that this ark that I'm going to build is going to be gone in 100 years, why am I compelled to do it? If I know that my hard drive is going to erode in thousands of years, why do I try? And of course, this is a very human story. It's a very small story, and it's also a huge story. There's a lot of conversations about what happens when you start thinking of geological time, which I think can kind of be overwhelming, very erudite and intellectual. And he makes them so playful and so accessible. And he, you know, invites his friends and his fellow documentarians and Werner Herzog, who's an executive producer on the film. And I just love that I never knew exactly where it was going to go. And he took me to, you know, the fjords in the Arctic and salt mines in the Alps and ancient libraries in the Sahara. And it's just, I was just in awe of the fact that he was able to harness all of those great conversations into something that I could recommend to anyone to watch and that they would be going along for the ride.
And his parents are a hoot.
Yes.
His parents are in it, and they're these super funny, quirky, no-nonsense people who are so supportive of him building a literal ark in their backyard.
We're talking about the documentary The Ark of Oblivion. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's NoHo 7 in North Hollywood. About Dry Grasses, a Turkish drama. The film is directed by Nuri Bilge Ceylan. Manuel.
We talked about Dune and it being like 2 hours and 46. About Dry Grasses is, if I'm remembering correctly, like 3 hours plus. And it's very patient storytelling, but I really enjoyed it. It sort of unravels at this like very slow pace. We're following this art teacher in a remote village in Turkey who's a little bit fed up with where he's at in life and his job. And there's an incident with a student that may have gone that may have become a little bit inappropriate and sort of starts unraveling his sense of whether he'll be able to sort of get out of this town. But at the heart, this is a story about, you know, how can we find our way to live with our lives and how can we escape them? And is that a selfish pursuit? I think this is a movie, to me, it was a movie about selfishness, about, you know, he has a lot of leftist friends who really want him to be more engaged and be more political. And he's like, I don't have time for that. And I don't really want to. And am I selfish for just wanting to lead my life? He's not a particularly likable character, but I think the movie does a great job of sort of trying to understand where he's coming from. And it's sort of, it almost feels like a short story because like it happens only during a winter. And then it eventually sort of balloons into these like larger conversations about politics and about the country and about sort of hope and hopelessness and cynicism. I just really loved it.
We're talking about the Turkish film About Dry Grasses.
Yeah, this would be a great double feature with the Teacher's Lounge. Mm. Because it's about people who are doing this job that is thankless, and then there is an accusation that upends everything to their routine, and you don't really know who to believe. Like, we've watched it all, but we don't really know, like, what's true and what's not. And that's not important. What's true and what's not is not the core thing here. It's like, how does it affect this guy's life? How does it affect his worldview? He is a jerk. I mean, not to the extent of, like, a Larry David type figure, but there is a sense with everything he does that it's transactional, that it's, how does this affect me? I mean, especially given that he is in this job where he's supposed to be helping to shape the youth of Turkey here, he can't even fake it that he has a calling. You know, he thinks he deserves so much more. What the filmmaker does is he sits in these long takes and lets the patience play out and the rhythms play out.
About Dry Grasses is at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. It's unrated. Many more films to come on Film Week on LAist 89.3.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
We're just over a week away from our 22nd annual Film Week Academy Awards preview at the Orpheum Theater, downtown Los Angeles. Beautiful historic venue. We're going to be joined by Chrissy and Manuel and nine other Film Week critics on stage. We'll see clips of all the Oscar-nominated films, and the critics will have at it, responding to each other and what they have to say about the top films that are part of the nominations. Arrive early at the Orpheum on Sunday, March 3rd, and you can step into our new Film Week recording booth. This brand new. You want to give a shout-out to Manuel and tell him about a particular film that maybe he mentioned that you wouldn't have known about otherwise, or tell Christy how much you appreciate her reviews, you can step right up to the Film Week recording booth right there in the lobby, and we might use that on a future Film Week segment as well. So please make sure that you join us. Also, we want to let you know that if you want to dress up in your Oscar finest, you can do that too. We'll have a photo op in the lobby with a nice Film Week background for you. You can do a step and repeat and have a friend take a photo of you all dressed up for the Oscar show. That's coming up Sunday of next weekend, March 3rd, 1 in the afternoon at the Orpheum Theater, downtown Los Angeles, just a week before the Oscars. Get your tickets now. Several hundred have already sold. We want you to get a good seat. Do it right now at LAist.com/events. That's LAist.com/events. We hope to see you there next Sunday, March 3rd. We're joined this week by our critics Christy Lemire and Manuel Betancourt. Next up is Io Capitano, which is an Italian drama. It's directed and co-written by Matteo Garrone. Christy.
This is one of your five nominees for Best International Feature at this year's Academy Awards. Speaking of our Oscar show, this is my least favorite of the five, actually, but very well made and well acted and ultimately very harrowing. It's about these two teenagers. They are cousins. They're living in Senegal. And they get this dream, this crazy idea to travel to Italy to become pop stars. You know, you see them writing songs. They'll hear a bit of dialogue. Someone will say something and they'll turn that into song lyrics. But they're not happy. They want more. They want fame. It's all very young and impulsive. So they get their money together and they figure out how to get, hopefully, smuggled into Libya and then eventually into Italy. And nothing goes as planned. And so we are with them every step of the way as they face different horrors, different awful, treacherous kinds of terrain. The structure of it felt episodic to me for a long time, like this happens and this happens and this happens. I found the score a little intrusive, needlessly so, and kind of at a disconnect with the visuals quite frequently. There are these magical realism flights of fancy, sometimes literal flights of fancy, that felt very out of place to me. I guess it's, you know, trying to be reflective of what they're thinking as they're trying to survive mentally. But then the final section on the boat as they are crossing the Mediterranean is shocking and so tense and so claustrophobic. The director will use long takes to really immerse us in what's going on with these people. But it definitely picks up. So stick with it. If you're thinking like, this is okay, it gets so much better. And the finale, that last shot and the line of dialogue that gives the film its title is quite powerful.
We're talking about the Oscar-nominated film Io Capitano, starring Sedu Sar and Mustafa Fall Manuel.
Yeah, I think harrowing is probably the word that I would come back to sort of describe this film. And it can be quite punishing to the point where Garrone really wants you to feel the horrors and the obstacles that people like these two teenagers will endure to leave a life that they wish to leave behind and in order to imagine a better version of the life for themselves, which they can only imagine somewhere else. It's very topical, right? Like, this is clearly depicting sort of migrant crisis in Africa and Europe, but I think we could also think of it the same way, the kind of migrant crisis that's happening here in this continent. And I think it really puts us in the mind space of, like, how far would you go? And how bad would your life need to be for you to uproot yourself and leave your mother and know that you may never see her again? And I agree with Chrissy, that final sequence in the boat, it's truly worth the watch.
We're talking about Io Capitano. The film's unrated in select theaters. The documentary Ennio is about the great film composer Morricone. The film is directed by Giuseppe Tornatore. Manuel, what do you think of Ennio?
Listen, I love Ennio Morricone.
Who
and I
doesn't?
Think exactly. And I think if you say there's a documentary about Ennio Morricone, you're gonna be like, well, regardless of it, I will enjoy it. Speaking of episodic, this is a documentary that sort of has him, and he gave all these interviews back in 2020, or right before he passed. And he has a lot of fascinating insights into his work and into how he did not just these like amazing scores that we all know, but hundreds and hundreds of others. He's one of the most prolific composers. But eventually the documentary sort of struggles and becomes, and then I did this score and this is what I did, and then I did the other score and this is what I did. And, you know, I want him to tell me more about how he created the music in The Mission or The Good, Bad, and the Ugly or how he works with Tarantino. But sort of as a film, it felt a little bit more like a masterclass than a documentary. I wanted a little bit more rigor. I wanted a little bit more sort of shape so that it didn't feel like, well, I'm just listening to him tell me about his course, which is, again, fascinating. But I don't know that a novice or someone who doesn't know Morricone would find a lot of interesting things to say. Although there's a lot of great people and a lot of great talking heads, but
we're talking about the documentary Ennio. Christie?
Yeah, he's very charming, isn't he? He's a lovely, warm storyteller, and he gets choked up with the memory of things that happened many decades earlier. And it is an incredible who's who of voices here, from Clint Eastwood and Quentin Tarantino to fellow composers like Hans Zimmer and John Williams, and like a wide variety of Italian producers and people that he worked with. A lot of really cool 60s Italian pop songs in here. That part's kind of fun. But I dug the process of this. If you like process, he goes into how he came up with different like contrapuntal song melodies, and like this shouldn't work with this, but it does. And like, where did the like, where'd the stuff come from that you know so well from all of his scores, like different sound effects? So I enjoyed that, but it is ultimately so repetitious in the fawning over him. Like, clearly he's a legend, right? But the same thing, the beginning and the end, is people over and over again saying the same thing over and over again. What's interesting is that one of his best-known scores, the one for Cinema Paradiso, is one that they don't really go into very much, given that Giuseppe Tornatore directed this too.
Right.
Like, that's his film. They go really far into the mission, and they go really far into why didn't he keep winning Oscars? Like that's part of it too. That's like a running through line of like, why is he not winning the Oscar? He's clearly a legend. It could be like a 2-hour film, I think, but this is like 2:47.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ennio on Ennio Morricone from Giuseppe Tornatore, the director. The documentary can be seen at Lemley's NoHo 7 in North Hollywood. Veselka, The Rainbow on the Corner at the Center of the World, is a documentary about a New York City Ukrainian restaurant. Veselka, Krisky.
Veselka is legendary. If you've ever been to New York or lived in New York, you know it's on 2nd Avenue there, and it's a hub of culture and amazing food and just a warm and welcoming place in New York City. And it became increasingly significant once Russia invaded Ukraine and became a place where people wanted to show their support either by just, you know, having dinner or donating diapers or donating money or whatever. So it goes into the whole history of this place, how it's been around for decades. The same family has owned it for 3 generations, and how it has evolved as a hub of Ukrainian culture and food and life in this part of New York City. I didn't realize how much it had shrunk. It was like many, many tens of thousands of Ukrainian immigrants who lived in this part of the east side of Manhattan. And now it's only down to like 20-something thousand. It's much smaller. David Duchovny is the narrator and does a whole lot of very schmaltzy hand-holding in explaining this place and these people. Speaking of too long, this is like 1 hour and 45 minutes. This would have been a nice, tight, hour-long film. It goes off in all these deviant directions. When it's the most compelling is when it's about the people who work at Veselka, who are Ukrainian themselves, who have family who are still there, who are trying to get out, and how this place is a crucial connection for so many Ukrainian immigrants. So there's the substance and the heart of it is worthwhile, but there's a lot of like peripheral, like very maudlin feel good stuff happening here.
Does it get into the food at all?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Watch them make pierogies. So, all yeah.
Right. I was going to say, it just makes me want to go to the
Veselka.
I have so many great memories of
late nights.
Yeah, I used to live in New York, so like I love a lot of late nights in Veselka.
And they talk about that too, how people will go to like CBGB, go see a band, and then like drunkenly stumble over to Veselka. So,
well, I'm sure that wasn't Manuel.
No, never.
Veselka, The Rainbow on the Corner at the Center of the World, a documentary directed by Michael Fiore, and it's unrated at Lemley's NoHo 7 in North Hollywood. Stop Motion is a film that uses stop motion animation, as you'd expect, directed by Robert Morgan, who co-wrote it with Robin King. Manuel.
This is not a movie for the squeamish, and I am sometimes very squeamish. So we're following this animator who sort of starts losing her mind when she loses her mother, who is also this very famous stop motion animator, and the two of them were working on this kind of like dark fairy tale. And as soon as she loses her mother, and now she's like, okay, I'm going to like finish this movie by myself. She starts having these visions, and she sorts her animated figurines start coming to life and start egging her on to become more deranged. And there's a lot of self-harm. And there's a young girl who keeps telling her the story that now she needs to tell. But like, you need to create this figurine out of red meat. And so there's a lot of like blood and gore and self-harm. And I can see Christy sort of grimacing. And that was me throughout the entire film. I was like, oh my God. And it's... I found that it was as an exercise in tension, as an exercise in sort of the horrors and how we deal with grief. Like it's very affecting. It's not quite my style. I think I wanted a little bit more. It's a little bit too small and it's very claustrophobic. We're mostly in her like makeshift animated studio with these like really creepy figures that I just wanted to get out of. But I think that also speaks to sort of the strength of the filmmaking, that I really just wanted to be somewhere else for that entire film, just as and of course it has this like very violent, very this is not, spoiler alert, there's not a happy ending in sight.
So live action and stop motion animation combined in Stop Motion, a horror film from the UK starring Aisling Franciosi. Robert Morgan is the director. It's rated R in select theaters. And finally, the documentary As We Speak, Rap Music on Trial. J.M. Harper, the director. Manuel.
So this is a fascinating documentary about something that I didn't really know that much about, which is the way that rap music and rap lyrics are continually being used by the justice system, both in the U.S. and the U.K., to prosecute rappers for even crimes that have nothing to do with their lyrics. So that there, a lot of places are using lyrics as character witnesses to be like, well, clearly they're singing about how they would, you know, kill someone else, and so obviously they robbed this candy store. Like, and it's sort of ridiculous, but it speaks to, and you know, this is bringing journalist, and we're following the rapper Kemba, who's sort of guiding us through this process. And they're, the main thesis of the film is how this is yet another instance of how black art gets constantly criminalized, and how, you know, if we listen to a country song and they're talking about, you know, I killed my neighbor, you're like, yeah, I get it. Or if they're heavy metal, like, we understand those lyrics to be fanciful feats of fancy. But somehow in rap, they get sort of really thought of as quite literal ways.
We're talking about As We Speak, Rap Music on Trial, directed by J.M. Harper. The documentary begins streaming on Paramount Plus Tuesday of next week. It's unrated. Our critics this week are Manuel Betancourt of Film Quarterly and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day YouTube and podcast series. They are two of our 11 critics who will be on stage coming up in just over a week, Sunday, March 3rd. We'll be at the historic Orpheum Theater in downtown Los Angeles for our 22nd annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. We'll be screening clips from all 10 of the Oscar-nominated Best Picture nominees. We'll be talking about all the major categories of the Oscars. There'll be a chance for members of the audience to ask questions of our critics who are on stage, and we want to make sure that you are there in the beautiful venue Sunday afternoon, March 3rd, 1 o'clock, exactly a week before the Oscars are given out in Hollywood. You can get your tickets right now, and I encourage you to do so at the earliest opportunity because they're going fast. Go to LAist.com/events to get your tickets. That's LAist.com/events. We want to see you there Sunday of next weekend, March 3rd, 1 in the afternoon at the historic Orpheum Theater. Coming right up, we'll talk with the Oscar-nominated screenwriter of Poor Things, Tony McNamara, on Film Week.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.